Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler Podcast, Episode 38.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Today on the show, we go swimming with whales at the Pacific island of Tonga.
Please take your seat and fasten your seatbelts. Also, make sure your seatback and folding trays are in their fully upright and locked position.
I have two quick news stories today that I'd like to highlight before we get into the interview with Chris talking about Tonga. The first one is something that combines my love of travel and my fear of writing great big checks for my kids for college, and that's a new program called The Scholarship. Scholarship.com, got links to it in the show notes, but basically it is a floating college semester at sea on a cruise ship that is just dedicated to be a college. So if you're interested in that, it is about the same cost as private school, which is to say expensive. And there are also openings for staff on that ship, so check that out in the show notes. The other thing that I have is someone has actually made a reality TV show that I enjoy. And that's a little surprising to me because there isn't a lot of reality TV that I've enjoyed, but the Travel Channel has one with a new show called Five Takes, which is taking five amateur travel journalists and sending them around the world. I guess this is the second season, but the first time I'd heard about it. You can actually also interact with the people as they're on their journey. They're in Australia last week. I think they're in Thailand next week. And if you haven't heard of them and you do interact with them, let them know you heard about them in the Amateur Traveler Podcast. And now with no further ado, here's an interview that I think you'll enjoy. I'd like to welcome to the show Chris, and Chris contacted me after one of the last couple shows, I think it was the show on Egypt that he responded to, and told me a little bit about an adventure that he and his wife went on, and I invited him onto the show to share the story. So what we're going to talk about today is Tonga, which I have never been to, and Chris, why did you end up going to Tonga? Well, first of all, where is Tonga?
Well, Tonga is an island in the South Pacific. It's southeast of Fiji and southwest of Western Samoa. And okay. It's actually a group of islands. It comprises about 400 islands in four groups. It's a fairly remote destination, but you have to fly through either Samoa or Fiji to get there for the most part.
And why Tonga?
Well, I have a thing about whales. And I really like whales a lot. And Tonga has a seasonal population of humpback whales. The population has been estimated at about 700 whales, but they migrate there in the Antarctic winter to mate and give birth. Of course, during the summer, they're back in Antarctica feeding. But Tonga is one of only three countries in the world where it's actually legal and permitted by law for people to go snorkeling with the humpback whales. So you can go there and not only watch them from the surface from a boat, like you would do in Hawaii, for example, but you can actually have the opportunity to get in the water and swim with them. And we thought that was going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and so that's what got us on a plane to Tonga.
And so planning, you mentioned before we started recording that planning a trip to Tonga wasn't all that easy.
Well, there's a lot of difficulty associated with it because Tonga is not a destination that a lot of tourists go to. It's just not nearly as popular as other South Pacific islands like French Polynesia, for example, or American Samoa or Fiji. And so as a consequence of that, the tour operators and accommodations there are not as modern and organized, and they're also much more limited in number than what you would see in the more heavily touristed destinations. So we ended up planning our trip, I guess, in late February and early March for an arrival in September, and frankly, that was too late because we ended up finding that a lot of the places to stay there, which aren't very many in number, were booked up, and we ended up having to switch from hotel to hotel every 3 or 4 days, just fitting together blocks of availability. So that was one challenge because, you know, the whale season is what drives tourism in Tonga, and if you don't plan way in advance, the numbers of accommodations are so limited that you can find yourself without a place to stay. So that was one challenge. The other one really is the relative scarcity of international flights into and out of the country. There's only one flight a week, I think, directly from Los Angeles that has a quick stopover in Western Samoa. And then there are other flights that go through Nandi in Fiji, or there's a Polynesian flight that goes. But really, you can probably count on one hand the number of international connections in and out of the country in a week. Hmm. And so you've got to plan your arrival and departure pretty carefully in order to, you know, get the length of trip that you want.
Interesting. So you started planning this trip about 6 months ahead of time.
That's right.
And what all did you do to prepare? I mean, what do you bring to Tonga with you? How much is available there and how much do you take with you?
Well, I think you probably need to count on taking almost everything that you need with you. You know, this was going to be a water sports-oriented trip. Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind that it was going to be the middle of winter, we were expecting relatively cool water temperatures in the low 70s, which turned out to be the case. And so we were going to not only be snorkeling all the time, but also doing some scuba diving as well. So obviously I took the essentials of my dive gear. You know, I take my own regulator, my prescription mask and snorkel, you know, my own wetsuit. My wife took her wetsuit, all of our photography equipment, an underwater housing for our camera, you know, everything that we thought we needed. The other thing, though, that we bought special for the trip, and I'm really glad that we did, was we bought our own hydrophone, which is basically an underwater microphone. The cool thing about humpback whales, one of many cool things, is that during the mating season, the male whales will sing this very powerfully loud, haunting song. And it's not clear entirely what the purpose of the song is. They believe it's either related to mating or to territoriality. But we were hoping to capture some whale songs on a digital audio recorder, and so we bought our own hydrophone and took that with us too. It ended up not being that expensive, and I'm really glad we took it because we had several great opportunities to record whale songs.
And for those of you listening to the show, I'll just let you know in advance that the song that will play out the end of this episode will be whale song. So Chris did share that with us, and it's just amazing to listen to. So I'm glad you took a hydrophone down there.
And yeah, it's amazing how easily those are available on the internet. I mean, I just saw on the internet a company called Aquarian and, you know, looked it up and bought it. And it turned out to be the same hydrophone that all the whale watching tour operators use out there.
Huh, interesting.
So there must not be very many brands of them.
Let's start with, what's the highlight of the trip?
The highlight of the trip has to be being in the water with the whales. And we got really lucky because on two separate days, we had extended, you know, 30 or 40 minute encounters in the water with a mother and calf humpback whale pair. And that has to be the highlight because those whales are incredible to watch in the water. And what's great about the mothers and calves is that the calves tend to be very curious about swimmers in the water. And we had this two-week-old humpback whale calf come straight up to us in the water and, you know, within 3 or 4 feet of us to check us out. And all the while, its mother was watching us, but never doing anything, you know, aggressive or scary, nevertheless being a very imposing presence with us there in the water. But being that close to them and being able to watch them for that extended period of time because they don't move around that much definitely has to rate as the highlight of the trip.
And we talk about the mother being an imposing presence. How large is a mother humpback whale?
They're typically around 45 feet long, and I think they weigh, you know, 40 or 60 tons, something like that. And they look really big in the water, I will tell you that. You know, the adult males are about the same size. And the very first day we were actually in Tonga, we went out on a boat and got lucky in that we got a solitary male interested in the boat. He actually came up to the boat and stuck his head up out of the water right next to the boat and was looking at us. So, of course, we jumped in the water with him. You know, he circled around us and went under us and was checking us out. And, you know, to have an animal that big be curious about you when you're in their element is a humbling experience, but also a really exhilarating one.
So it sounds like the whales also come to Tonga because they get to swim with humans there.
Well, you could say that about some of them, but I would probably tell you from our experience it was a minority of them who had that interest. Because most of the time, you know, the way that the whale watching works is they have no technological means of spotting the whales. You know, they don't have aircraft in the air or sonar or anything like that. Basically, the drill is you go out on a boat and you look for them visually, and when you see them, you attempt to approach them. They can be very skittish about boats approaching them, and you have to approach them quietly and slowly and respectfully so as not to upset them. But even under the most careful of circumstances, it's very common for them to react to the presence of a boat by putting their flukes up in the air and diving and staying underwater for 20 minutes and coming up a mile away. And so, you know, I would say probably 85% of the time when we approached a whale or a group of whales, that was the outcome. We would get near them and they would disappear. So it certainly was the exception rather than the rule that we would find a whale or group of whales that was interested in hanging around to have people swim with them.
Interesting. What was the biggest surprise on the trip? You'd done 6 months of planning, so theoretically you knew what you were going to expect.
Yeah, I don't think we had much in the way of surprises. You know, we did end up having some of our plans not followed through by some tour operators, but we had really been told to expect that by other travelers who'd visited there. It just doesn't have a tourist industry that runs with the efficiency that a more heavily touristed destination does, and it certainly reminded me of the Seinfeld episode where he talks about you can take the reservation, but you can't keep the reservation. That's something that I think happens with some degree of regularity there, but we were expecting that. We did end up having a bit of a surprise when we took a land tour of Vava'u, which is the one of the northern island groups where the whales are hanging out, and took a hike that was unexpected without really the proper attire on. And we hiked through a fairly thickly vegetated field and ended up getting a lot of insect bites doing that. That was probably the most unpleasant surprise that we had of the trip.
What sort of thing should people know before they do the same trip that you did?
Well, it's really a trip that caters to a specific type of person. Mm-hmm. Because, again, given that this is not a very heavily touristed area, you should know going in that you're dealing with hotels and other accommodations that, although comfortable, are not to the standard of luxury that you would find in some place like Bora Bora, for example. Mm-hmm. They don't meet, you know, anything more than probably about a 3-star standard in the United States. So you got to understand that you're roughing it to some extent by going there, and you can't expect to find glitzy, modern, resort-type properties there as you would find in some other parts of the South Pacific. Definitely people should also know that because it's not a heavily touristed destination, that things like changes of plans and delays and reservations not being kept are just part of what you need to go with in order to have a trip there. And the other thing that I think, particularly if you're going there to swim with whales, it's critical in my mind on any trip that involves wildlife as its focus, but this one particularly, to devote a sufficient number of days to swimming with the whales, because, you know, we had days when we'd go out and didn't really have much luck. And you've got to, you know, they're wild animals and they have their own agenda, and it's important to devote as many days as you can to give yourself the biggest chance of having a great encounter happen. And we ended up having it happen twice, maybe three times, in 5 days of whale swimming. But certainly you could not expect, as a matter of course, to simply schedule 1 day of whale watching and have it be perfect, because sometimes it just doesn't happen that way. They are wild animals. So that's probably the other thing that I would tell travelers, is to devote enough time to that activity to give a really good encounter the chance to happen.
And we talked about this a little before, but what would you wish you had known before you had gone?
Well, the the one piece of equipment that ended up not working very well for us was the underwater housing for our digital camera. We bought one that was going to fit our existing camera that's kind of a soft case with a glass port on the front of it. Mm-hmm. And although it worked in the sense that it kept water off of our camera and we didn't get any camera damage, it was really bulky and cumbersome and difficult to use underwater. And as a consequence, we ended up constantly taking the camera out of it just so we could take pictures while we were on the boat of whales on the surface.
Oh, sure.
And so in retrospect, I really wish that we had bought a second smaller digital camera, like a PowerShot G5 or something like that, mm-hmm. because they make these small, clear, hard underwater cases for those small handheld digital cameras, and those work really great underwater because you're not, you know, underwater, you're never going to be taking a picture of something very far away, so the ability to zoom in and out is not that big of a deal. Your subject's always going to be relatively close. And if I were to do it again, I would have gotten a small, compact digital camera and one of the underwater housings that Sony or the other companies make and taken that with us for underwater pictures and had that separate from our land camera.
And just again, because you told me this before we started the recording, you took how many pictures, did you think, on this trip?
Well, it's typical for us on any trip to take, you know, 3,500 pictures or so, and I think we did that on this trip as well. My wife really enjoys photography. It's one of the primary motivations she has for traveling. And, you know, she subscribes to the theory that you can't take great pictures unless you take a lot of pictures.
Sure.
So she does so. And we travel with a portable hard drive so we don't run out of space.
Okay. Yeah, I subscribe to the same theory, but my family tends to get a little impatient as I take pictures around 1,100 pictures in a on a trip or something like that.
Oh, gosh. I remember times when, you know, we've been sitting there and she, like when we went to Machu Picchu a couple of years ago, I think she took 600 pictures just of Machu Picchu that one day. But some of them are just fantastic. So it was well worth her effort, I think.
And we're going to get some of those pictures. Chris is going to, and his wife are going to share some of those pictures. And for those of you listening to the iTunes enhanced version, hopefully we'll have some pictures that will illustrate their trip some. So when you're not in the water at Tonga, what are you doing? What is there to do other than the swimming with the whales or going out?
Well, there's some additional water activities that I should probably mention. Mm-hmm. Tonga is, and Vava'u in particular, is a really world-class diving destination.
Okay.
There's two dive operators on the island. Both of them are excellent, and the reefs are incredibly rich with coral and sponges, sea fans, and all manner of different kinds of fish and nudibranchs and all other kind of crustaceans and things like that. So I did a day of scuba diving while we were there, and it was fantastic. The water visibility is typically in the 100 to 150 foot range, and the dives aren't terribly deep, so they're suitable for people of any experience level. There's no heavy current involved, and so that's a really big activity for people there. Obviously, people go out and take snorkeling trips as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of land attractions, you know, Vava'u is a very thickly forested island that has a lot of scenic overlooks and caves to go look at and things like that. But if you're wanting to do land activities, I would probably recommend spending a few days on the capital island, Tonga Tapu, which is where the capital, Nuku'alofa, is. And they have some really interesting things on Tonga Tapu. They have some archaeological ruins of past monarchs' monuments, including a big stone gate called the Trilithon. They have a memorial plaque where Captain Cook landed there. There's a cultural museum that you can go and see. And, you know, one of the things Tonga has going for it is that it was never colonized by a European power. So they're as unspoiled a Polynesian culture as you're going to find in the South Pacific these days. And they have a great museum on Tonga Tapu that shows you, you know, different artifacts and other things from the history. The other really cool thing that's on land on Tonga Tapu is on the western side of the island, they have a several mile long stretch of shoreline called the blowholes. These are limestone islands, and over the course of years, holes and fissures have been eroded in the limestone shore. And as big waves come in from the west, as they do with the prevailing winds, the water will force its way into these fissures, and there are dozens of these blowholes that will go off all up and down the coast and shoot air and water, you know, and mist into the air up to 100 feet tall on a day when the waves are strong. And to go out there and look at that was a really spectacular sight. Frankly, I could have stood there and looked at it all day. I mean, we got some great pictures of it, and we really had a good time looking at that. The other, I guess, land attraction that you see both in Vava'u and on Tongatapu is the flying foxes. It's the only terrestrial mammal that is indigenous to that area, and there are these big fruit bats that have a wingspan of about 2.5 or 3 feet, and they fly around, and they're very large, and you can take some pretty good pictures of them if you're patient. So that's definitely a must-see, I think, for anybody who goes there.
If you're very patient and if you don't get totally freaked out like my daughter and wife did when we saw them in Sydney. But,
yeah, well, I mean, they certainly can have that effect on people because they're so big. Fortunately, they're herbivorous, so they don't pose much of a threat to people.
You said, and I'm not sure that everybody caught it, in terms of the Polynesian culture on Tonga, the previous monarchs, Tonga is still a monarchy.
That's correct, although perhaps not for much longer.
Okay.
They're undergoing a lot of political change at the moment, and in fact, when we were there, the public servants were on strike, and they were protesting some government policies that they didn't like, and I think that strike has really awakened the people there in a way that has caused them to want to be more involved in the affairs of state, and I think you're likely to see in the next few years them transition the monarchy into more of a ceremonial role than an absolute power role, which it has been up till now. And you can already see some signs of that. For example, the Tongan king just appointed the first commoner as the prime minister of the country, which had never happened before. So that was, I think, a step in the direction toward democracy that you can see them heading into.
Interesting. Language in Tonga, they speak?
They have their own language, Tongan, but English is very widely spoken. Tongan is a Polynesian language that's not dissimilar to Fijian and Samoan, although it is different. It's quite similar, but we didn't find anybody who didn't speak English.
Okay. Any last thoughts on Tonga? You'd go back, or you have so many other places to go that...
I don't think that we would probably go back, because having had the experience of being in the water with the whales, you know, we probably wouldn't prioritize going back. If you're the kind of person who really enjoys being in a very quiet, isolated place that's not overrun by tourists, that's the kind of person I can see going back to Tonga again and again.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we don't necessarily need that in our travels. So having had the incredible experience of swimming with the whales, we probably would not return there. Not that there's any reason not to go there, because we really enjoyed it, but we have so many other places that we'd like to go, we don't try to repeat anything.
Sure. No, I understand. I can relate.
Sure.
Well, thanks, Chris, so much for being on the show and for sending us whale songs, again, which we'll close out the show with, and pictures that hopefully people have been looking at this whole time.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on, and thank you very much for the service that you do the traveling community by producing this podcast.
Oh, thank you. If you haven't been listening to the iTunes enhanced version of the show, which has pictures of Chris's trip, you can check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com, where I've put up a gallery. The gallery does include some pictures that were not in the iTunes enhanced version as well. It seemed odd to me to hear Chris describe the Amateur Traveler as a service that I'm doing for the traveling community. I'm just having fun. And I really particularly enjoy when people who've been listening to the show write me and tell me about their travel experiences, and it's fun having someone like Chris on and meeting him through the show, and I find that this just gives me more people to tell travel stories to, so thanks again. For the internet resources for this particular episode, Chris sent me a number of links that they used in their planning for the trip to Tonga, so if you follow the links to the show notes, you'll see a lot of different information about Tonga and how to book various travel accommodations, tours, and find out news about Tonga. In the community section, I had some great feedback this week, both on MySpace. Don't forget to add the Amateur Traveler as one of your friends on MySpace if you're interested in the show. So thanks in particular to Mignon and Jody for the nice comments that they had about the show. I heard from my friends and former traveling companions Jim and Marilyn in feedback to the first video edition of the Amateur Traveler, which I don't know if you've checked out yet. It is a demo of how to use the kayak service to find good fares. And Marilyn noticed that as I searched for fares from San Jose, California, I used the airline code SJO. The San Francisco airline code or airport code is indeed SFO, but SJO is San Jose, Costa Rica. And this is something I should remember because I spent 15 minutes one time at JFK Airport arguing with the United counter agent that he had just booked my luggage to Costa Rica. And he was not willing to believe that he had done this until I finally was able to convince him that San Jose CR was Costa Rica, and he finally looked it up after about 15 minutes of rather firm but polite conversation about not desiring my luggage head to Central America. I am interested in if anybody has any short videos for the Amateur Traveler video edition. I'd love to take user submissions of that. I do have a second episode, which is a driving tour of San Francisco, which I just need to put some soundtrack to. But if you have just a quick 2-3 minute video that you'd like to send me, no more than 5, I'd like to keep that video edition short, feel free to send me video and I'll use that if you give me permission to do so. Here's an odd opportunity for some of you who may be poker players. There is a podcaster poker challenge coming up a week from today, so that would be Saturday, April the 22nd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. That is a free tournament, but with real prize money. There's $2,000 in the prize pool for people to play for or against various podcasters. And if every podcaster you knock out of the online poker tournament, you get $50 in bounty. Some of us ought to be fairly easy. So that's something you might look forward to, although there's some possibility that since I signed up for this that my wife and I will go out of town next week because my kids will be in Mexico. But I am signed up for that, and I thought I'd let you know about that. If you were interested in registering, check links to that in the show notes. Also, a question for you. Sometime, probably not this year, but maybe next year, I have thought about the possibility of doing an Amateur Traveler cruise or an Amateur Traveler trip. And I don't know if anybody's interested in that, but I'd be interested in hearing some feedback. One company that I had talked to at a travel expo was a company that does small group trips to the Galapagos Islands or Costa Rica or some places in Central America. So let me know if that's something that sounds at all interesting, if you'd be interested in hanging out with other people who are travel lovers of travel, like myself and like you, apparently. Thanks to the others of you who took the time to write this week. To Anne, who's heading off to Turkey, who posted on the discussion board some of her experiences in Egypt. I'm hoping to get Anne on the show when she gets back from Turkey. And to Wes, who heard about the show through the National Geographic Traveler, who's doing a trip coming up to a Eurail trip from Spain to Budapest. So that also sounds interesting. If you don't know how to write the show, the email address is host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also call me on the voicemail line, which is 408-512-1083. To close out the show for you, before we get to that promised whale song, I have two promos for you from podcasters. The first one is a promo from Joseph Nilo, the head of Podcasters Confessions, as well as the Mac Pro Podcast. I'll put a link to this in the show notes, but basically he is doing a series on the Biltmore House in Asheville, North Carolina. And it's a huge travel destination if you're in North Carolina. He's doing an audio and video podcast of that, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes if you want to check out what Joseph is doing for that. A wonderful fellow. I'm sure you will enjoy his work. And then I have a promo for the Real Deadwood podcast.
Wild Bill and Calamity Jane are here, and now so are you. From Deadwood, South Dakota, this is the Real Deadwood podcast with Paul Dennis.
This is Paul Dennis speaking to all fans of HBO's award-winning series Deadwood, from the real Deadwood in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The enormous popularity of the HBO Deadwood series has created a worldwide demand for information about the real Deadwood. So I've created a show featuring entertainment, interviews, music, and news from both Deadwoods called The Real Deadwood Podcast. Every episode has interviews and audio clips with the actors and crew members from the HBO Deadwood series, historical facts and stories about old Deadwood from Deadwood's Adams Museum, interviews with musicians and artists performing in Deadwood, South Dakota concerts and events, sound-seeing tours starting with Mount Moriah Cemetery, the current home of Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane, music from bands featuring some of the HBO Deadwood actors, as well as local Deadwood and Black Hills artists. The RealDeadwoodPodcast.com website has show notes with video clips, photos, and links. The website has received hits from over 30 countries around the world, proving how popular Deadwood is now to people all over the globe. Check us out on iTunes in the movies and television category. Subscribe to the Real Deadwood Podcast today and find out what the Real West was and still is all about.
I'd like to thank my employer LiveWorld and the president Peter Friedman for providing the bandwidth for the Amateur Traveler Podcast. LiveWorld is a leading provider of online community, and our most recent client is TV Guide at tvguide.com. And now, here is the promised whale song. Thanks so much for listening.
Best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Podshow and Limelight.